Welcome to AMD Tech Talk, your source for the latest in data center innovation and insight on AMD's latest technology breakthroughs. And now here's your host, Jim Green.
Thanks for listening today. Our guest is Rebecca Weekly, Vice President of Infrastructure at Geico. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Jim.
Hey, Rebecca, since we last talked on the podcast some months back, you've got a new leadership role in the industry. Can you share a little bit about what you're up to now?
Absolutely. Like you mentioned earlier, I was at Cloudflare running infrastructure engineer, which was a wonderful, really, truly dream job. So it's funny to say that and then to say, and then I was given an even bigger job opportunity working for an amazing leader, both our CEO, Todd Combs, as well as Harry Govind, very committed to digital transformation and thinking through how the infrastructure enables our business to grow more effectively and serve our customers better. And the ability to be core to that business and make it better through digital transformation and modernization, I got hooked, Jim. I got hooked.
I have to tell you, I was super excited to hear that you're working at kind of at the heart of the enterprise, undergoing the type of transformation that we talked about for so long on the supply side of technology here. Being on the other side of the table for you must be kind of a really interesting point of view now. Do you have any key experiences that show this as a different and totally new opportunity? And do you have to view technologies different? I would imagine you get to see problems very differently.
Absolutely. There's a lot of questions there. So I'll start at the beginning. In terms of being on the enterprise side, when you're operating a large-scale cloud, right, something like Cloudflare, where we're in 700 physical sites all over the world, the complexity is how you deliver different services and different configurations. It's corner cases. It's the scale issues that you find releasing code in all of those different systems that will lead to race conditions that were unexpected. So it's almost self-inflicted, but it's a needle in a haystack problem that is really around complexity of scale. When you're in an enterprise, it's also a needle in a haystack problem, but it's around a lack of visibility, a lack of control, and a lack of observability. And I don't think I fundamentally understood that until I got into this seat. And maybe I'll give an example. When you have a series of ISV stacks, right, or a series of vendor-locked solutions, and the source code is not observable, it is not inspectable, and often when an issue occurs, your only action can be to call your vendor and to have them look at it. But they don't have the context of your environment. They don't have the context of the application that called that stack. They just can tell you from an error or a trace log that they get what might be happening. And you kind of ping pong back and forth trying to figure out who's on first, what's on second. And that is an incredibly frustrating place to be in as a leader who's used to open source stacks, open configurations from a hardware perspective, where we own our own destiny and we can control what we're doing. So probably very clear in my statement, my bias of I sit in these conversations and I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't think you're giving me any value. Vendor stack locked in with your own observability that now I'm spending so much time writing scripts to extract to try and understand what's going on so I can build a dependency mapping tree so I can finally get everything to run the way I need it to run. So a lot of my fun sitting here is taking a legacy environment, looking at what the actual functions need to be, and then tearing the whole thing down and starting over, clean, fresh, new, and showing folks that this over architecture, over design of SANs and demilitarized zones and explicit appliances for every single firewall and it's just a policy. That's just a policy. We can enforce that policy in software. We can enforce that policy with excellent encryption methodologies and high entropy key generation. Like, none of this has to be in all of these distinct things, which creates single points of failure, challenges right. In terms of scaling of your systems, real fear around driving upgrades, which in fact would make you less secure, less capable, worse reliability. So breaking down so that we can control our own destiny, see our own data, and actually build what we need to build to support our business. Every day, I get up and I get to fix something. And I love that.
So that's great. That's a super perspective there. I was wondering how your point of view would transform, because one of the things you hear in a lot of discussions is customers say, I need more visibility. And as you try to unlock visibility for them, at some point it becomes overwhelming. It's like, whoa, no, that's too much now, right? So what's the right balance of visibility and accessibility to data so that you can do something interesting? Absolutely. And at your point, do it at scale. It's a totally different beast than solving one block, right?
Yeah. And I think the history for a lot of enterprises was find a vendor you trust, have them train your team on how to administer their systems, and then just keep doing the upgrade cycle with that vendor. But the problem is either those vendors have changed, or the backend systems have changed, or they weren't well maintained, or Hocktan acquired them and they changed their cost structure by 14x, or whatever the reasons that drive people wanting to go away from that stack. And all of a sudden, the inability to control your own destiny, right, to actually get in there and figure out what was supposed to happen, the lack of observability becomes the boat anchor that you have to carry forward, either in crazy cost changes or in having to tear these things out and replace them with more logical systems.
Either way, pretty disruptive. One way people have been using AI is to use it to try to address some complexity, right? To gather data and to make sense out of some of the data they now have visibility into. But really, it's how do you manage that, right? Because AI can be a pretty intergalactic term here. So in terms of a real practical, everyday, large enterprise business, how do you manage that in the context of how you evolve your IT infrastructure? And could you give a couple of examples of how Geico is using AI technologies today?
Sure. Within the infrastructure space. And when I think we talk about infrastructure, I think some people think this is the IT closet in the back room. Like, no, we have six physical data center locations. We have a large cloud footprint. And the way infrastructure runs at Geico is we are responsible for everything other than the application stack. It's the core platform that is enabling the hybrid cloud experience. So that's why I talk about ESXi and everything from Linux runtime containers, Kubernetes clusters, how we do identity and access management, how we do secrets management, that whole PKI flow. That's all infrastructure here at Geico, right? So it's a lot of software problems in the hardware space, just to clarify. But we use AI everywhere within and have had to forever. Think about a document repository system, right? Like optical character recognition, OCR integrations have been in doc repos for 15 years, 20 years, at least 15. So there's been AI usage across either ISVs as well as homegrown stacks for years and years and years and years and years. When you think about just a server system, there's 10 to the 10 parameters that can be tuned, from like your fan table and how you modify that curve to optimize your power delivery. There's everything that you can do in terms of cache and quality of service, over-indexing or under-indexing, doing soft constraints, hard constraints. Like there's so much to tune just in one system, let alone across six physical locations and a large cloud presence. Of course, you need to use AI for workload placement, for optimization, for capacity planning, for all forms of forecasting, for ways in which we look at all the problems of serving our core business. That is like billing back-end systems. And you need to make sure that those systems are resilient and reliable. So failover, load shedding, business recovery solutions for continuity. All of that is automated functions that need to occur in the event of certain signals happening. And that doesn't mean that humans aren't involved in the process. There's lots of AI. I think we all think ChatGPT and LLMs and hallucinations, but you know, this is not a new space. This is a space that's been around for quite some time. And there's a lot of machine learning, data analytics, automation, and AI that has been active in the ecosystem for a very long time. And it's necessary. It's more than any one human can hold in their head.
Yes. And like I said, it's a way to convey and extend human knowledge, because humans can't be everywhere all the time, right? So it allows you to augment.
Generally heuristical based models, right? Like a human has inspected and said, in the event of these signals, these are the actions we want to take. So you automate the response. You don't automate the logic process. There are places where you might be able to infer or learn from the data the logic processes. But that, I think, is, again, something we explore further in the domain space of very large data sets. Mm-hmm. I'm not operating at such a scale that that's maybe the right choice. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit in the supervised space of saying and automating, in the event of this, go do these things.
Yeah, the mundane call and response type activity certainly benefits from that level of automation. So you've got a very pragmatic view on AI. And as you mentioned, you also accurately portray that AI, and we're all doing the finger quotes here, has been around for a long, long time. You know, classical machine learning and the like has been foundational for such a long time, but it's now getting much, much higher visibility here. And we're also seeing more in what I'll call kind of the traditional everyday applications. You mentioned just a couple examples of them that are now being AI augmented with upgrades or enhancements here. When your business partners or your suppliers come to you to talk about AI enablement here, how do you look at these things? Do you look at it as essential enhancements, something that's valuable or something you do opportunistically, or is, you say, pure fluff? This is the same old, same old.
All of the above. Can I answer all of the above? You know, sometimes it's really fluffy, right? Like it is just automation around log signals, and it's all about the integrations they've actually run with all the different possible backend tools. And inevitably, they cover 30% or they cover 40%, but not 100%. So I'm going to spend all this time doing integrations anyway, is the little bit of sort of anomaly detection that they integrated into the tool actually worth it to only cover 40% of my stuff? The most important thing is that I have full coverage of my logs, not necessarily their model integration. And so I have to do the work myself anyway, because I have logs from 17 other sources that I have to go process. And I can use OpenML and pull down an anomaly detection model that's pretty darn good and actually enable this for myself. So I think that the value really comes down to the combination of the integration for the systems that you have in my space. I mean, obviously, very, very infrastructure engineering centric approach here. But when I see a lot of these conversations, usually the ISV makes a ton of assumptions about the environment, and it's usually the environment they've come from. And they miss the value of the integrations, the value of actually collecting and making it easy to integrate or collect information from alternate sources. And that tends to be the over-under on whether it's of value to me or not. If I'm going to spend 60% of my time doing integrations, I might as well just build it myself. They're not enough value, right? So that usually is my space. I think about tech supplier management and contract management. And those are areas where possibly you need to have several lawyers and several this and several that review, is this non-standard language or standard language? Or you can pull a data set on standard language that's already been pre-trained and allow the tool to go crazy. Not really a core skill set that most technologists have. And definitely always harder, Conway's Law, when you have to go across multiple teams to get the right kind of insight, give them enough technology understanding on the contract, give you enough legal understanding on the contract. That's an area where, you know, there's an ISV place where the situational context can be really valuable. I think Workday has kind of proven their value as a SaaS player in the HR domain. So I think it's really finding those places where there's a really strong contextual baseline. And when you're trying to go across legal and HR and audit and backend compliance and some of these different multi-org structures, where an ISV being able to kind of stitch those together in common best practices, common flows, can have value above and beyond logging.
Right, right. So that horizontal stuff makes sense. Do you see a similar role in kind of vertical, departmental, or functional? Maybe functional can be the horizontal bit too, but almost like in terms of expert systems.
I see the value in experts. It's an interesting question. Maybe let me make sure I understand it. Do I see places where very deep verticalized integrations can be of value? I think when you think about, I'll give you an example. I just trashed logging, right? Which logging and monitoring for events can be done a million different ways. There's a million different integrations. It's always like, how do I pull the correct exporter into blah, blah, blah. But there are companies that have built a deep vertical space around logging, particularly for hybrid cloud, like Splunk, that have a lot of value in that domain and in what they're using and in the intelligence that they can provide, basically from tracing, from logging information. So there's always the counterpoint of practicality versus where somebody has been able to really create a very valuable industry product. But again, I think it's because they've done such a good job working across all the different clouds and creating an excellent experience at the enterprise level for the hybrid experience, right? And they do that by basically controlling load balancing and management, not just logging. So there's a little more to it to actually deliver the value.
I imagine suppliers are coming to you four times a day with, hey, now with AI, right? As part of the pitch here. So
only four times, Jim?
On a good day. On a good day, it's
four. My LinkedIn, I feel so inundated daily.
Good points. Touche. So does AI enablement change your hardware requirements or your cloud requirements? Do you see that this value add, the function they provide, that expert system and that horizontal stitching of functional role enablement, does it change your hardware requirements yet? Or are you seeing it as a more subtle overlay to your traditional business processing?
AI is probably, well, I would say graphics was the first thing that drove transformation of hardware systems, right? GPUs started for graphics. And certainly, it continues to be a domain space where people are optimizing their systems. Interestingly enough, back to the expert systems versus sort of unsupervised LLMs, potentially more generative AI solutions that are more inherently creative versus ones that are sort of overseen. Those are, I think, driving the largest hardware transformations. And I think we're more trending towards machine learning, more traditional models in that domain space because of our business, right? Our core business is a rate to risk model. And we're regulated. And our job is to make sure at any time, the entire flow of any regulator can understand why we priced a policy at that level. And we can prove there was no bias in it, that we did it ethically. I don't think anybody who's using an LLM today can definitively say there's no bias. That's just not the nature of it. There's bias in the data sets that they train upon, and therefore there's bias in the models that they use. There's bias in all of us humans as well. But if we use explicit rules that we have proven are allowed to be used as a regulated industry, and we can show that log and audit trail, we're very defensible in our use of machine learning. And so, again, not that I should speak about the core business because I don't run that. I run the infrastructure. But in our core business, we want to make sure we're always operating based on the rules. And that means you're going to encode the rules explicitly, not let the computer think them up. So I think there's a lot there for a lot of the industries that are regulated and how they're going to look at AI. AI is not inherently bad, but you do want to make sure that you're doing it ethically and that you have the right oversight and controls to ensure that the use case doesn't double down on implicit bias. I think, does that change our hardware? Absolutely, it does when we actually are looking at deeply pipelined approaches. GPUs are excellent. General purpose GPUs are excellent for solving those problems. But there's a lot outside of training that is inferring from the model, even data pipeline preparation, making sure that you've extracted it from the database, et cetera, et cetera. So for every minute you spend, I'm just making up a number, but for every minute you spend training that model, you infer from it 1,000 times more. And most of that process, while the fundamental inference can happen faster on a GPU, there's a lot of cases where the overall data prep and the overall migration from the core CPU out through the PCIe link to the GPU or across multiple GPUs can actually outweigh the performance overall end-to-end for the system. So I tend to look at precision, accuracy, the amount of time that we're spending in the compute and the overall workload and not just an ML perf score to understand what and where and how we're going to run a workload and then try and make sure our placement is based on that. All of that is to say, we store a ton of data because of our business, right? Mm-hmm. We store obviously everything with your policy, obviously everything in terms of what it took to get there and why we made the decisions we made, all of your interactions that have been a part of serving you as your business, all of that has to be stored for years, sometimes decades, depending on what kind of data it is and how it's regulated. So we store a lot of data. And you asked, the second part of your question was not how is AI changing our hardware, but is it changing our cloud strategy? And I think that is where it's driven our biggest changes, because storing data in the cloud is expensive. There are great options. You can make it glacial and never touch it, and it's a lot less expensive. But when you actually want to touch it, which is what you have to do, and you can't really predict when you're going to have to do that because it's maybe when a regulator asks for it, that's when it gets expensive. And if you want to do it in order to make insightful decisions about your core business on a regular basis in a proactive fashion, all of a sudden it's 30 times more expensive, 30% more expensive. Kind of depends on how the data is accessed, in what formats, in what timelines. And so what we have found is storage in the cloud is incredibly expensive and it's disparate. We have different storage in different clouds for different systems, when inherently to serve our customers better, we want to be able to pull all that information together and train on it, on your history of transactions, so we can serve you better. That implies bringing it on-prem is both cheaper for us to store it, but also faster for us to process it, yep, to give you a more accurate claim, to give you a faster response time when you have an incident occur, when you have a claim that you're going to make, so that we can actually service that and get you to a repair center so that you can get back on the road and not be largely inconvenienced by this unfortunate, yep, thing that happened in your life. All of that means, absolutely, AI has transformed our cloud strategy. It starts with our data. And we don't own enough of our data to serve our business at the rate at which we want to, because it is so hard to get cloud data out. Egress rules are getting less expensive, so they're reducing some of the cost structure of getting your data out. But even then, your SLA between clouds can be 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So if I want to give a response to a customer in 15 seconds, if I want to give you a claim closure in 15 minutes, I can't do that across six clouds, seven clouds. That's not logical, right? So having access to your data with predictable timelines so that you can build accurate models about what their risks are so that we can price things effectively, that really has made us think differently about our infrastructure, about our cloud strategies. Using the cloud where the cloud is great, and the cloud is great. It's great for experimentation. It's great for ephemeral computing. It's great for super low latency to eyeballs out in the wild. I want to make sure our mobile app works perfectly, whether you have gone off on vacation in Italy and got hit by someone in their little Fiat, or if you are at home. I want it to be exactly the same. So again, that's where I'm not going to build infrastructure in Italy. I'm a US company, but the cloud does. And that's perfect. I'm going to continue to use cloud there. But for our core business, where I need predictable responses and the ability to unify my systems, I can do that cheaper, better, faster, stronger on-prem. And so that's a big change. And it's why I'm here.
Well, I'm glad you came back around to tie this to the business, because that really is fundamentally why businesses make the investment, right? So how do you see the use of AI technologies? Is it changing your views on the commitments you can make as that infrastructure owner to the business? Does it enhance your confidence to deliver the performance or efficiency and capability to make your business look as one, right on top of stuff, worldwide in any instance?
Oh, you know, absolutely. And it's a lot of work to get there, right? We have a lot of work to do to ensure that the automation and failover and traffic management operate at the level we need them to. But do I think it's possible? Absolutely, I think it's possible. Probably with all the arrogance and whatever of having done that in a bigger scale. And so being able to apply it here where the problems are not as complex, they are much more tractable. They're really tractable so that we can deliver to a service objective that is well educated, well sort of defined by our business and our leadership teams. So yeah, I say arrogance, I put my tongue between my teeth because I'm sure I'll find 50 different ways that I could have been better, stronger, smarter about this. But I come back to it and say, it's not rocket science what we're doing. We're trying to make sure that our flow for doing rate to risk model analysis, serving our customers in their claims, serving our customers when they ask for policies is fast and unified across our lines of business. This is not the hardest problem I've ever solved. So I have faith that I can do it better, stronger, and faster. And there's enough components of it that, of course, AI and automation has to be leveraged. That is a given. That's not the inherent reason. The inherent reason is that the modernization of the application stack, the modernization and control of our own destiny and how we refactor it gives us the opportunity to build better automation and tooling so we can do faster failover and faster incident response.
So you've touched on cloud repatriation, and you've talked about AI enablement, and you've talked about ripping and replacing and starting from scratch. So how would you sum it up here? Do you see your infrastructure evolving over the next couple of years? Oh, are those kind of the big three, or do you see other big changes at hand?
Yeah. I mean, we are absolutely doing application modernization in terms of ensuring that the stacks themselves are running, leveraging best-in-class containerization. I'm going to give you an infrastructure-centric response when somebody who's actually writing unified communication queues and various other factors could give you a better response for how they're doing application modernization. But from my lens, that's making sure people have access to Kubernetes, that it's designed with high availability zones and all of that. It's making sure we are leveraging and building the kinds of teams that can support open source software, whether it's operating systems to integrate security patches and controls. And so there's a lot. I mean, Jim, if you look at my LinkedIn, it's I'm hiring. So there's a lot that I need to do to bring in the right talent to build and control our own destiny in delivering these open source stacks and in delivering open hardware systems and being able to conduct that. Those are, you know, an important part of making sure we have the right people here doing that work and helping do that work and making sure we have good support for our legacy systems because we're still running on those legacy systems, whether that's DevOps tooling in our public clouds, whether that's on-prem systems. So stabilizing those, automating those, understanding their dependencies, building migration plans and tooling to migrate so that we don't have any kind of service outages for our customers, right? Totally critical. And an important part of where the team that's been here and has these systems is deeply involved in driving the future of our company forward. And then I think it's making sure that it's less complicated in what we're getting to, thinking through that data estate logically, so that we're not constantly shunting bits all over the world, but we're radically optimized for where we need data when we need data in alignment with our compliance and our security, all the things that we need to do to serve our business well. That's kind of a three-stage plan is make sure it's better, make sure we migrate it, make sure we ensure that it's done with a thought to where our business is going, all with better unit costs and better latency and experience overall. And then that enables us and our other parts of our business to think about net new ways in which we serve our customers. And we've reduced the load and the complexity of the legacy stuff so that they can think up new ways to be absolutely awesome for our end users, whether that's on mobile devices or leveraging different solutions for an integrated user experience. I don't know, Jevons paradox. It's the classic case where as soon as you make it better and give them more capacity, they'll come up with great new ways of using it.
That's right.
I want that problem right now.
Feed the beast. Feed the beast. Yes, indeed.
Exactly. Right now, so Rebecca, can you support us? You know, I need to get them away from that to the place of like, of course, Rebecca will support us and we'll go forward.
You've got an incredible mission here and you mentioned your LinkedIn. How do you recommend people that are interested in this type of mission follow up and continue the conversation?
If you want to be part of digital transformation and actually making sure that we're serving our business well, please reach out. I really, truly am hiring all over the stack, hardware systems engineers, network engineers, all the way through OS container runtimes, database systems, like name your favorite flavor, we're here. But more than that, the exciting time in our industry is other leaders, other folks that are going through and thinking through their data and AI strategy, how we're doing that together, how we're handling legacy stacks that have vastly increased their cost structures. I sort of talked about one of mine, but there's lots where there's a little bit of a cash cow mentality happening. And how do you take control of that so that you can run your business in an effective fashion to serve others? I think that's a dialogue area that I'm always passionate about. There's a reason why I was the OCP chairperson, and scaling innovation for everyone is a goal. That's ultimately, I think, where we see users served best. So, I mean, in terms of reaching out, you know, these days I'm on X a heck of a lot less, and I'm more focused on LinkedIn kind of communications. Although every once in a while, if you tweet at me, I'll try and figure it out.
Fantastic. Hey, this has been a great discussion, Rebecca. As always, thank you again for sharing your insights with us today.
Of course. It's been a pleasure, Jim.
And thanks to our audience for listening as we talk tech. Until next time.
Thanks for joining AMD Tech Talk. Find out more about the technologies discussed today at www.amd.com.